Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. T.S. Eliot once wrote, "I have measured my life out in coffee spoons." Many of us start our mornings with a cup of java and then drink another in the afternoon to make it through the day, and some people reward themselves occasionally with a specialty coffee drink. Most of us coffee drinkers are particular about our coffee rituals, how we select it, flavor it, and when we drink it or share it. Not surprisingly, the people who make specialty coffees are just as notional. How they select, roast, and sell their coffee is driven in equal measures by their ethics, personal philosophies, sense of wonder, and taste. Abracadabra Coffee, a small coffee roaster based in Woodstock, Vermont, is a case in point. They're pushing the envelope by doing things like infusing their canned products with hemp and CBD. Joining us now to talk about the process of bringing specialty coffees to market are Abracadabra's co-founders, Antoinette Hunt and Clint Hunt. He is also the company's head roaster, and co-owner Sarah Yetter. Welcome to our show.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Clint, you've said Clint, you said that if it weren't for Starbucks, Abracadabra wouldn't be here. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think Starbucks, lent a great deal to education to the American consumer. They brought the terminology of espresso and the milk-based drink latte to the forefront. I think before that, it really wasn't discussed or heard of. So I think that they, paved the way for the current third wave of coffee, so to speak. So I think it was a great thing for them to do, and led to people paying attention to what maybe was going in their cup.
Third wave. What are the 3 waves?
The first wave, I mean, this is generalizing, but the first wave of coffee is what we consider. We used to go into instant coffee, maybe in the 50s and 60s. That was kind of just
not
everybody's cup of coffee, anything like that. Second wave is where really Starbucks came in and started to introduce those different flavored elements, roasting pretty dark roasted coffee, but giving people a little sense of an additional add-on to their drink. And the third wave is kind of what was going on in the last maybe 10 years, where we're starting to focus more on traceability and sustainability and in all aspects of coffee, and then pushing that envelope into terroir and flavor of region.
Well, since you're inspired by Starbucks, are you thinking of running for president?
No, I don't. I'm going to let some other people do that. But yeah, I did hear about that. I find that quite entertaining.
Let's bring in Sarah.
Hi.
Do we know when people started roasting coffee beans and brewing coffee?
I think that might be a better question for Clint, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Clint?
You can get that. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. The history of coffee is always fun. So it's been, it's been around for a very long time. Coffee originated in Ethiopia. It was originated, there's an origin story of a dancing goat discovered from a goat herder and, eating the coffee cherries and so on. So there's a lot of mythology to the origin. It really was starting to be consumed and traded as a commodity around the 1600s with colonialism. So starting in Ethiopia and Yemen, and then being traded, and then that evolution throughout those countries through colonialism is what kind of spread generally from the 1500s onward through all of the different phases of coffee evolution, I guess, so to speak.
Well, mostly in the Arab world, and the Sufis were particularly taken with coffee. But why do we call it coffee? Doesn't it come from a Dutch name for coffee?
Cafea. Well, the Dutch is really what had their hands in spreading the initial noble tree there. So I think that that was their part of the colonialism aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, they had colonies in Africa.
Yes.
So, Antoinette, let's get back to you. Let's go to you. What's the story behind the name of your company, Abracadabra? You're saying there's something magical here?
Absolutely. When we were starting the company, we were kind of, you know, deeply interested in mysticism and those aspects of, you know, of the name origin, which has different meanings. It was at one point worn as an amulet to ward off evil, as well as some say that it means I believe what I, or I create what I speak, and that really said a lot to us as we were jumping into starting a business. You know, we use that as sort of our mantra starting out to keep us going, and we really love the imagery as well. So the triangle, we feel, has, you know, is a very strong shape and has a lot of power in itself. So between all these aspects coming together, that sort of shaped our decision to call the company Abracadabra.
Actually, coffee's had some negative connotations over the years as well. In 1511, coffee was forbidden by conservative Orthodox imams at a theological court in Mecca because of its stimulating effect. And then there was a similar ban imposed in Cairo in 1532, where the coffee houses containing coffee beans were actually sacked, although those bans didn't last for long. Their concern was that coffee was a stimulant because of its caffeine.
For sure.
By the way, Sarah, could you turn your radio down because we're getting feedback?
Absolutely. How is that?
Yes. Didn't you start off, Sarah, with alcoholic beverages as a cocktail mixer and wine taster? How did you wind up in the coffee business?
I did. I did start off in the wine, spirits, and craft beer world, actually. And it is a really great segue into coffee, especially with wine, because coffee and wine have a lot of, like, similarities in the way that they're analyzed and tasted and even grown.
Although wine has a calming effect and coffee has a stimulating effect.
Definitely. Coffee, being an agricultural product that is seasonal, so each crop, each year, you know, each harvest is different, definitely like wine in that way. So that's why I found it very interesting. And also so many different flavors and aromas that you can get from coffee, more than wine even. So that's definitely what led me to coffee.
Clint, how did you learn the craft of roasting coffee? Is that something you have to go to school for?
You definitely don't have to. I know some people roast coffee at home with a popcorn popper or in their oven or even on a pan like traditional Ethiopia, you know, style. But I did go to school for it. But originally I worked for over a decade in coffee, started off as a barista at a local coffee shop and then really got involved with a roaster in Columbus, Ohio, that was pretty progressive for the time, doing a lot of things and really pushing the industry. So luckily I was in that field for a good number of years before I moved to Vermont. It wasn't until I moved to Vermont about 10 years ago that I decided to start roasting coffee for ourselves mainly, and then eventually led into a business. But I reached out to a lot of old friends that were still roasting coffee just to get some information. I did all the other aspects of the industry, from selling and buying and all the other things, but not roasting coffee. So I had a good understanding of what it was or how it was kind of evaluated, but it really wasn't until I bought a really small roaster and started the experimenting process and trying to take in as much data as I could and just trying to analyze through trial and error, and trying to taste as much as I possibly could to understand what I was doing and the manipulation and how it affected the coffee.
I know some people who believe that, the reason that they're roasting coffee is that they believe that green beans have a long shelf life, but once you've roasted them, they have a very short shelf life. So it isn't just a matter of grinding it at home, it's also of roasting it at home.
Right, yeah, you can definitely get more bang for your buck that way. You know, you can buy some green, roast it, you can have it a lot longer in your shelf, but if you do put it in a cool, dry place and have it in an airtight container, you can still have whole bean coffee last, you know, a couple of months, I would say. You know, I would try to go through it quicker, but yeah, if you did it yourself, you could always have more more control.
Do you think it's best to grind it right before you make the coffee each morning, or, well, whenever you make the coffee?
Yeah, I mean, if you're coming at it from a quality standpoint, then for sure, I think it's best to always try to grind as you go. But, you know, not everyone has that lifestyle. So, you know, if you don't have the funds to purchase a nice burr grinder, you know, you got to do what you got to do. So if you have to buy ground coffee, that's okay too. But if you're looking for the best quality coffee, then grinding as you go with a good grinder, hopefully, that'll yield the best result for sure.
Can you fiddle with the roasting process in order to bring out certain flavors or aromas?
Oh, most definitely, yeah. So you're taking this raw product that is extremely dense, and then through how you roast it, you're going to initially first dry out the coffee, get the moisture out of it, the water, so you can start the browning reactions, the caramelization phase and the Maillard reaction. So you're going to take these carbohydrates and break them down to simple sugars, and you're going to do all this magical stuff to it. And how much heat or how long you roast it or how much airflow, all of these things that you're doing affect the ultimate end result.
And does it depend on the kind of bean that you're using? Would you adjust it if you were doing something from Kenya as opposed to something from Costa Rica or Hawaii?
Yeah, you know, so yes, for sure. All coffee is different, just like any apple is different from farm to farm, or any wine is different. So we kind of approach it with our back knowledge of how coffees that were maybe similar. So you look at the processing method. So how was this coffee processed? Was it dried in the sun with the fruit on it remaining? Was it washed completely? Was it, what's the elevation of the farm? Then we do density tests in the beginning just to measure those, to look at, well, how much heat should we start this process off with the roasting? These all kind of give us little guidelines to the roasting process and how we're going to approach that roast. Then from there, we will cup, multiple cup, you know, that's a sensory evaluation where we'll cup the coffees and taste, and from there we'll figure out, well, this is, you know, shining a lot more this way, or maybe we want to bring out more acidity or showcase more of the sweetness. So yeah, every little tiny detail matters in the end of the cup there.
And if you want to bring out the acidity, would you roast it longer or in a different way?
No, so typically not. I wouldn't say that. Longer, and then again,
more heat,
every question for coffee is funny, because there is never a hard and fast rule for anything, because every roaster is, like actual coffee roaster is different in the drum and style and all of that, but I can give you our simplification of it. So for acidity, you typically, if you're going to showcase like a Kenya, like an acidic, like really nice coffee, you're going to roast it a little bit lighter. So coffee tends to be acidic on the lighter side, then gets maybe more sweet and chocolatey as you go through the development phase. And if you keep pushing longer and hotter, it'll start to go into those more darker roasted flavors until it eventually will be carbonized into like an Italian roast or something like that.
So we would
tend to lean towards the lighter side.
You've said that the seasons have an impact on roasting coffee. In what way? How does winter change the taste of coffee, for example, right now,
well,
during this very cold season?
Well, let's see. So winter, I guess, you know, coffee is grown around the equator between the tropics. So but it would winter affects us, especially up here in Vermont, because as a roaster, we're, you know, the ambient temperature, the air temperature, is a big impact on the coffee. So we definitely have to take our roast profiles or our roast recipes of how we're roasting the coffee and continuously tweak them based on how the temperature is changing around us. And that's just like an ongoing process. It's always chasing the dragon, is what we call it. The same thing with espresso.
I've heard that a coffee roaster in Brooklyn was forced to shut down his operation because his neighbors complained that the aroma of the roasting coffee was too powerful for a residential area. How powerful is the aroma?
Well, so I don't know. It definitely smells like nice bread to me. Mm. You know, when I worked in Columbus, we were in a residential area in Grandview, and you know, you might get somebody complaining about it, but ultimately, everybody liked it. It was like a nice addition to the neighborhood. It was more like, oh, we're producing something here, and it was a nice, pleasant smell. Mm-hmm. It wasn't anything.
I like the smell.
You know, off-putting.
I'm speaking with Clint Hunt and Antoinette Hunt and Sarah Yetter of Abracadabra Coffee from Woodstock, Vermont. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Antoinette, how difficult is it to launch a coffee brand? Do you need to have a lot of infrastructure?
I wouldn't say that you need an incredible amount of infrastructure. We grew it very cautiously and organically, pretty much almost completely self-funded. So that being said, we were trying to keep our overhead really low in the beginning, starting off with, you know, first Clint roasting part-time and going to different markets to sell what we were roasting and gauge whether there was really a place for what we wanted to do in our area. So that being said, mostly, you know, we started out buying the equipment, the roaster, and then from there we had to scale up to a larger roaster, and now we're on to our third larger roaster.
And you had a custom roaster built? What did you ask
We did.
What did you require in a custom roaster? Might I, if I were opening a roasting place in here in Brooklyn, would I want a different kind of roaster?
It really depends. There's a lot of different opinions when it comes to, choosing a specific roaster. I think Clint could probably speak to this because he's done a lot of research and analyzing and ultimately decided, since he would be the one spending the hours roasting, which one he wanted. Clint, do you want to mention?
Yeah, well, it depends on for sure. I think that if you're in a large city, you're going to need an afterburner for sure. So, like, something that kind of breaks down all of the smoke, so you're not going to have that, like you were talking about, a complaining neighbor or anything that's going to affect somebody down the line. There are little add-ons that you can do with software or computerized or automation or all the things that you may want a coffee roaster in this great day and age of coffee. We still do everything manually by hand, roasting wise. So there's a roaster. If we're roasting coffee, somebody's there tweaking every step of the way, the gas, how much airflow is changing, and then watching and monitoring it as we go. The only major thing that we required is that we wanted at least 6 sensory probes so we can track every aspect of that roast profile throughout the roasting process. And other than that, we just wanted it all in matte black to look so awesome.
Do you think that similar things are being done at the major coffee companies, chock full of nuts and Folgers and such, or do they just simply... they simply just try to come up with the same non-vintage coffee all the time.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I can speak for Folgers. I think that those are different style of roasting altogether. That's convection, usually on a large, large scale. You're using just hot air, and those are really, really fast roasts. Those are done in 5 minutes. So you're just so, you know, I can't even probably... 500 pounds just continuously getting roasted that quickly. But when you look at a company like Starbucks, they just opened the Starbucks Reserve, I think, in Brooklyn just now. They opened another one. So they're going back to specialty again, so where they're going backwards a little bit. Not backwards, it's actually forwards, but they're going back to the drawing board, so to speak, with their company and trying to put their hands back onto roasting carefully. So they have a reserve line, which is more in line with specialty coffee, again, the third wave.
Well, what is the difference between a commodity coffee and a specialty coffee? Is it the way it's processed, or does it stem from the bean itself?
I think that, well, there's a lot of things that are different. The easiest is how it's actually traded. So commodity, is on the stock market. There's a C market that is gauging how that is bought and sold, and there's a price on it. Those are really large farms that are looked at for a really low volume, low cost. Specialty coffee is hopefully traded based on quality and sustainability. So you're buying coffee for how good it is, and then ultimately how well it's prepared by the farmers, and hopefully they're getting incentivized back by paying a higher premium for the coffee they're producing. That's ultimately what specialty is, in showcasing transparency and trying to connect the dots to this first world country, typically getting coffee from third world countries.
Well, coffee may have originated in Ethiopia, but now it's grown all over the world. Are there certain coffees that you prefer to work with?
We're interested in anything that's exciting. So, there's currently a lot of different varieties of coffee that are really exciting, or processing methods that are allowing the farmers to put an extra add-on and an added value to their product. So if they can take a coffee cherry and then maybe strip some of the fruit off but leave some of it on, it's called a honey process, and play with how long it's dried in the sun, or play with, this and that. They can have a unique touch to it. That we had a coffee from El Salvador recently, Finca San Jose, that had wine yeast added to the fermentation tanks just to add another little element of depth to the coffee. So anything that has experimentation, anything that has an excitement, or anything that's just pushing the boundaries of what coffee is, we're always leaning towards that. It gets us really excited, and we're passionate about everybody, the producer side all the way through, doing unique things.
You said that your dream is to source all of your coffee from individual farmers. Is that possible? Because there are a lot of small farmers all over the world, and then there are all those other complicating issues like fair trade and organic.
Yeah, I mean, the dream is still there. Whether or not it's going to get there, I'm not sure. It's not a necessity for a lot of small roasters to do this. There are great importing companies, and you can still actually establish relationships with farmers now in the day and age of the internet and all this great stuff. So we have connected with farmers in Guatemala. This last year we just had some direct relationships where we actually purchased from them, and that was a really great thing for us. But we just want to make sure as we go forward that every company we buy coffee from, it's at the third party, they're helping push the industry forward. So we need to know how much those farmers are getting paid. We need to know the conditions of the farms and so on. So it is a little bit more work on our end to make sure all those steps are put in place, where eventually if we can build these relationships, which take time to build, but eventually if we can build them and continue to put more money back into these farms and then yield better results for the next year's crop, everyone will win.
Sarah, as you said earlier, one of the final steps is cupping coffee. What happens if you don't like the coffee? Do you just throw the batch away?
I think it's a part of the quality control process. So we could say, what can we do different, or what do we want to bring off in this coffee? You cup the coffee, you get a sample, and then you would sample roast it and then cup it and decide from there whether the coffee will be purchased. So then when the coffee comes, test roast again and then cup it and then decide, you know, how you want that coffee to be. And then if it's great, you will still cup it throughout. And as you guys were talking about earlier, just how the ambient temperature affects the roasting process. So you want to always be cupping that coffee with every roast, just to make sure that it's, you know, tasting delicious.
Clint has described a Costa Rican coffee that Abracadabra sold this summer as like drinking a cup of hot chocolate. What makes some coffee taste like chocolate and others taste fruity and others more acidy? Is it all just because of the roasting?
A lot of that has to do with the coffee where it's grown, the terroir. So, you know, there's a lot of
So this is like wine.
For sure. There's a lot of volatile chemicals. There's, you know, tons of chemical components, just as many as wine. So, and all of the different acids that you would find in fruit, malic acid and so on, are in there. So how you, there, it's how it's grown, first of all, like how high the elevation is and how it was cared for, the plant variety, and then how you roast that coffee to bring out those things. The longer you will roast the coffee, you'll be burning out essentially those acid components. So if you wanted a chocolatey coffee, you know, you're gonna lean on the sweetness. So you're gonna maybe lengthen that Maillard reaction, that middle phase where you're browning and getting all those sugars. But it's a little bit more like that. A lot of those coffees have such depth to them. So it is a very detail-oriented process. The Costa Rican, I think that we were talking about, that was a black honey process. So very similar to a natural processed coffee. So the seed, the coffee bean, is dried with the majority of the fruit pulp left on it. And that's going to add another element to giving it a little bit more fruit in the end result of the coffee. The sugars will go into the seed. And then, you know, it's a Costa Rican coffee. It has all these other usual, like, chocolate notes. And what it really tasted like was just a dessert in general. If you roast it correctly and then brew it in a nice way, you can get these really nice, complex tiramisu kind of flavors out of it.
But so the terroir in this case is the Costa Rican soil has given the beans certain characteristics that you wouldn't find elsewhere. You've said that organic coffee isn't necessarily better.
Well, you know, it's not that it isn't. It's not the certification is a great thing, and I think that ultimately, I hope that someday down the road we'll all have this amazing organic coffee that is tracked. But I think that the certification as a whole is definitely not driven by quality. I think that's where, that's, I guess, what I was probably talking about, is that organic certification for a farmer is great. But they have to follow this really long list of requirements all the way through transporting it across the sea. And then on our end, roasting it, you know, with all of our specifications. But those are value added. You have to pay a lot to be certified. And then ultimately, you have that as a set flat rate for how much you get paid extra to your coffee cost. So it's not really incentivizing the farmer to grow a better quality product. They already have it set in place. It's not really saying, hey, you should do harder work next year than you did this year. You should produce a better lot next year, because they're still getting paid that flat rate. It's not based on a quality-driven market, if that makes sense.
Sure. Coffee certifications, aren't they designed to help consumers select products that reflect their values rather than...
Yeah, for sure.
Rather than and indicating in any way that this may taste better than the other one.
Yes, some people... Yeah, exactly. And I think some people have... different values based on if maybe their values are our taste, or maybe they are really, you know, set on organic or shade grown or anything like that.
But I would prefer to have coffee that didn't have an awful lot of pesticides that have been poured on the beans as they were growing. So isn't organic in my best interest?
I think it is. I think that if you follow the quality-driven market, though, I think you would see that these farms, especially from a single farm lot, a micro lot coffee, they're not going to, I don't really foresee, I can't speak for everyone, but I don't really see these small producers who are producing coffees that are scoring 86 and above. I don't really see them dumping a bunch of pesticides. I would really see that as lowering the quality of their coffee. So if you follow quality, typically you're following good farming practices, which usually end up in the organic realm. I'm not saying that they're doing everything perfect, but it's similar to any, you know, in the United States, or especially where we're at in Vermont. If you follow small local farmers around here, a lot of them are not certified organic, but they are using organic practices and they're producing the best that they can, but maybe they can't afford it. But if you follow quality, it'll tend to lead you to the best, and typically, I would say, the organic practices. It's not certified, so some people, you know, really need that verification.
We're talking coffee on Leonard Lopit at Large. Is being in Vermont something that makes you different than being in New York, or, well, there are roasters right here in New York City? Do you have different issues that you have to deal with?
I would say definitely, Leonard. The population in Vermont is, you know, it's pretty scattered. It's a low population state. Really, it's a rural state. In Brooklyn, I mean, it's a different set of issues. So in Brooklyn and New York City, there's so many people, and I think it would be like being a small fish in a very large pond. And here, people focus on quality and farm-to-table kind of things, wine and especially craft beer, but specialty coffee hasn't really hit the consciousness of, you know, the typical Vermonter. So I would say that's a little bit different.
But you're not distributing your product around the country.
We are, actually. We ship these nationally and sell directly to retail customers all around the world, actually.
This phone is a problem. The other phones are coming in perfectly clear. That one, I don't know, something is wrong with it. But do we know whether Abracadabra coffees are available in New York City?
At this time,
at this time we aren't distributing to New York City. We are probably going to be working with a cafe in New York. So stay tuned for that. You'll be able to get Abracadabra at one of the cafes. But we do, you know, we do all online sales. We distribute our cans to statewide to Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and also full distribution in Vermont. And we sell them directly from us online as well.
So you sell coffee in bags. You have your own packaging system, but also in cans. Are we talking about liquid coffee in cans?
Yeah. We do everything from, you know, sourcing the coffee, as we've been discussing, to roasting as well as brewing. And then we work with a contract brewer who helps, you know, who we set up with to can all of our cold brew products, which we have three different SKUs of cold brew coffees in cans that we started distributing ourselves here in Vermont. And has really taken off within the last year. We are looking to distribute eventually nationwide. So with the cans, the beans, we are able to ship, you know, anywhere.
But what about what are the three types? I know one is hemp, another one is CBD, and we'll get into that in just a moment.
So the three different SKUs, we have a white labeled can that is our profile, flavor profile for that one stays the same, which is usually a kind of light, kind of citrusy, fruity coffee. And then the black labeled can is what we have as a nitro coffee. So that is a flavor profile that we rotate the coffees, but it stays the same as a more chocolatey, nutty, rich coffee. And then the third SKU is the one you mentioned with the hemp-derived CBD, with that is a MC. It's a fractionized CBD oil that we get from a local farm here in Vermont who grows everything here.
That comes out of, well, hemp related to marijuana. Is marijuana legal in Vermont?
Yeah.
It is. Clint, yeah, you might know.
It is definitely, yeah, it's legal. We're legal for recreational use. We're not selling it right now. Apparently they're working on setting up a system for buying and selling.
And CBD is being also offered to some people as a kind of a drug. I mean something to help people who are in pain. Does your CBD coffee have that impact, have that effect?
I think so. I think, CBD in general is used for a large multitude of reasons for people. And like you said, a lot of people use it for pain relief or anxiety or for sleep. So when we add that to the coffee that we use, not only do the flavors mesh really, really well together. We chose a specific Ethiopian coffee that is really, really juicy and paired with the CBD of the hemp, which is really dank and floral. It's a really great flavor experience, but when you actually consume it, that experience is like a really nice balance between the caffeine buzz that you would normally get, but it also relaxes you down, so you actually have this interesting effect where you're really alert, but you're really calm, and it hits you right in the middle, so you can kind of get work done, but also stay relaxed, and it kind of continues through for about 6 hours or so. So it's a really nice experience.
I was wondering if it's something of a chemical oxymoron to mix a stimulant with a relaxant.
It's like a hippie speedball, kind of.
There's a lot of people feel decaffeinated coffee is an abomination, but you say all three of you drink it all day long because otherwise you'd never get any sleep. Is that it?
Pretty much. I think we're all experiencing age a little bit, and I think it's all affecting us slightly different. So, we cup coffee all the time. So we're always trying coffee and tasting coffee and making sure the quality control is there. But as far as actually consuming tons of coffee, if we really want to just have a beverage like Antoinette is currently drinking a decaf right now, just for the experience of it, but also, we like really focus on quality-driven decaf as well. I mean, there's a lot of decaffeination processes.
How do you decaffeinate coffee beans?
There's a long list of, not really that long, probably 5 to 6 different processing methods, all dealing with solvents. Right now we're using a Swiss water process, decaffeination, which you basically take coffee beans, soak them in water. They add a extract to the pool, which basically will pull out the decaf, and then they'll separate it later. And that's kind of a typical thing. You'll use some people. It is a process, though, so it is an interesting way. So we're trying to go and find the most natural way to decaffeinate a coffee. It also produces like a really good taste. So there are really interesting methods. There's a sugarcane process where you basically will steam the coffee you put it in water, you'll steam it for 30 minutes. Then you use the ethanol acetate, which is, it's actually from the sugarcane being fermented. So you add that to that pool, and that'll pull out the decaf. It'll like bind to it. So then you just take that out. There's a lot of interesting ways. And if you start with a really high quality coffee, then it won't really lessen the coffee experience in the end if you do all the steps correctly.
So is that what you tell people who say, decaf just isn't as good, it just doesn't taste as good?
We definitely don't do that. We stand behind our decaf, and it's sourced through an importer. It was actually started in Guatemala. The farmers started their own importing company because they had all this great product, and it was hard for a lot of these small farms who have really small plots of land to to get a higher amount for their coffee, so they started an importing company. And I always work with them specifically for their decaf because it just is so good. So, and I've heard this across the board. So it doesn't have to be what you think a decaf is. It can be, you know, it's another experience that you can have that can be an enjoyable one.
Getting back to the hemp, Antoinette or Sarah, where do you get the hemp? I read that the Vermont Standard reported that the state is considering converting a jail in Windsor County into a hemp cooperative.
Yes, it's true. We just heard
that's
that.
That's ironic.
Gotta love Vermont, you know?
Yeah, but that jail probably had a lot of people who had smoked pot years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty ironic for sure. So everything that we use, we are partnered with Loose Farm of Stockbridge, Vermont, and they grow everything organically. Again, as Clint touched on earlier, they're not certified organic, but their practices are all organic. And they grow and produce everything on their farm. They use a supercritical CO2 extracting method for the CBD, which is one of the highest quality, best ways to do it, to keep all of the benefits of the plant intact, and then to have that come through in the end product. So the CBD oil that we use is grown here, and they use that extraction method, and then, you know, we get it as an oil, which we add to the cold brew coffee.
Clint, you said that one of your most memorable experiences, coffee experiences, was in Greece. Do they have really good coffee in Greece?
You know, it wasn't, I think that was more, it wasn't basically like kind of what you were saying earlier about, it wasn't really a quality-driven experience. It was more of it was environmental, I suppose. So it was just the whole, you know, when somebody says I went to Paris and I had this pastry that was blowing my mind, because I think all of the elements tied in. So that was just more of an experience of driving around on a four-wheeler on this island all day. And then we popped off at this little shop and had, you know, a typical Greek coffee, really sweet and similar to a Turkish coffee. And it just kind of like, it's a memory that stayed with me, I think, for the longest time. It'll be there forever. And I think a lot of people have those stories about what coffee can do for you, and it can do a lot for relationships or for the world. It's funny how people have those stories about their memories of coffee.
In a lot of cities, including New York, the arrival of specialty coffee shops seen as a mixed blessing. I have a friend who lives in one of the hip neighborhoods of Los Angeles, and he said, we have 10 coffee shops, but we don't have a supermarket. So it often means the neighborhood is gentrifying and locals will be pushed out. Is that something that people in your field even think about?
Definitely. I mean, it's something that I think, well, I mean, personally, I've known about this my entire existence in the industry. So I'm pretty sure everyone's very aware of that word and coffee, and it's very real. I mean, it's a real thing. And it's a complicated situation for sure. I find it, you know, like, I guess that situation is interesting. Why isn't there a grocery store? I mean, I know that there's deserts for that, but it's too bad. It's a real problem, I think. And I think that's kind of the progression of the industry as a whole. I think, you know, we were talking about third wave. What does it mean? These are all just words. But ultimately, I think if we actually started talking about what is the next step in, I guess you could call it the fourth wave. I don't know why, but maybe. It would be involving everything from the cultural aspect of that. So involving more of a community aspect. And you know, the coffee has always been an inclusive thing. So I think that would be the next step, is to try to like bring specialty coffee to everybody and make sure not to be exclusive. It's a complicated thing, though, for sure.
Is it a generational thing in your coffee shop? Do you find that people of a certain age tend to order different kinds of coffees than people of a different age? Younger people, for example, do millennials have certain favorite kinds of coffees?
I would hesitate a little bit on that one, because I don't want to be ageist, So I think there are...
It's okay,
really,
you can.
I think that there are a lot of people, if you're interested in food and wine or anything, we get people all ages that come in that are want different experiences. They want, you know, a pour over of this really amazing standout coffee, or they just want an Americano, or whatever. We try to meet everybody where they're at. So I don't think I would say the terminology of, you know, specialty coffee is definitely easier. I think it's more known for younger people. I think they've grown up with it more. Where you would, you know, obviously have older folks who maybe are set to an older standard, and they're kind of, that's their go-to or their tradition. But everybody can change, and I think that's kind of the role that we're trying to play is in trying to help educate people to what coffee is, what it can be, and hopefully they come away having a tasty beverage and a good experience. And I think that's what we're trying to do.
Antoinette, according to the Census Bureau, Vermont is the most rural state in America. Is this something that you've had to contend with?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as Sarah had mentioned, the population is, you know, pretty small. It's a small state. So for us to even, you know, get to work or anywhere that would have anything that of interest is at least a 20-minute drive typically for us. Outside of the small town that, you know, our company is in. So it has its challenges, but it also has a lot of benefits. We found that community is huge here because of that reason. So, you know, a lot of people have been super supportive of entrepreneurs and startup businesses because they want to have access to these things here. And, you know, you don't really want to have to drive an hour away to get a good cup of coffee.
Do the locals appreciate this? This past summer, Abracadabra requested the town of Woodstock allow you to stay open longer and invite food trucks to serve. Was the community's receptive and supportive of that?
Absolutely. I think that what we were requesting for our particular location was something that was a little different and had a special set of challenges that the town wasn't really prepared for. A lot of the laws that are in place take some time to change, and when we were faced with some of those challenges, a lot of the community around us rallied, and that's what, you know, the end result was. Because of all of that support, we were able to pass some of these laws that weren't typically in place. We have our friend who has a food truck, Tacos, who comes down every Sunday now and collaborates with us, and people can come and get, you know, something a little different than what's been available here in town. So yeah, the community has been a huge part of that. When we went in front of the town board, we ended up having about 30 people, maybe the most that I think they'd had at one of the select board meetings for determining, you know, what the outcome was going to be. So it was a real win for us, and I don't think we would have gotten there without such community support.
Have you people looked into the origin stories? Because there are so many conflicting ones. For example, coffee became associated with Muhammad's birthday, and various legends ascribe coffee's origins to Muhammad, who, through the Archangel Gabriel, brought it to man to replace the wine which Islam forbade. And then there's another story about, well, that would have taken place a little later, that involves a Moroccan Sufi mystic who was traveling through Ethiopia, observed birds. You mentioned goats, but in this case, birds of unusual vitality. And so he tried the berries that the birds have been eating, and he said he experienced some vitality, and that led to Sufis drinking coffee.
Yeah, I think the origin story that we're most familiar with and most enjoy is the story of, you know, the goats, the dancing goats.
Mm-hmm. But we don't know whether any of these things are true.
I don't think Google existed back then. I don't know. It's so hard to say.
Yeah, Wikipedia probably never researched the goat. But do we see anything like that? Is that likely today? Would animals eat the berries in the raw?
I'd assume so. I don't think that would be cost effective, but I think that if they're chewing on it, I don't know about birds. That thing's kind of wild. They're super. The seeds are really hard. There's not much fleshy fruit on them, so maybe you could chew on it. I mean, humans, you can suck on it. I mean, that's the thing. You can get some of that caffeine, and they don't. You know, you don't want to eat a lot of them. You mean like the fruit? There's not really much, but I don't think it would be really enjoyable.
In the just a few moments that we have left on this show, if our listeners want to make the best possible cup of coffee, are there certain procedures that they should follow? Do you have a recipe for making the best cup of coffee? Would it require special equipment? Do you have to have a really good couple of machines, a grinder and a coffee maker?
You can do.
Do you like the plunge version?
Yeah, the AeroPress is great. Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah.
Or are you talking about French press?
Yeah, French press. Either one. What do you recommend?
Yeah, either one. You can. You know, the main thing that you really need to focus on is having fresh roasted coffee that's in a package that is sealed in correctly. So if you can get coffee that's fresh, that's the first. You're up to a good start there. Like if you have coffee from a local roaster, or if you make it to a cafe, if you go to a grocery store and it has a roasted on date and you can see, oh, this coffee was really fresh. That's a great start. So you take the coffee and there's a couple steps that you really need to focus on. Just try to have filtered water if you can. That's a great thing. You don't have to have a reverse osmosis system or something like a cafe, but if you have at least filtered water, buy a bottle of filtered water. That's a great start. And then from there, it's just hopefully you have a burr grinder. Now, if you've got an electric one, they're going to, you know, be at least $100. But if you can get the hand grinders, their ceramic burr, Hario one is a great one. They're like $30, and you can take that and travel with it. Those are great. So that's a low-cost entry point. So you have $30. If you had just a tea kettle to heat up the water, don't add really, really hot water. So if it boils, definitely let it sit for at least a minute. The optimal range is about 195 to 205 degrees for brewing coffee. So you don't really like scorch or burn it. And so if you had a French press, that would be extremely easy. You could use the tablespoon style of weighing or volume, but we always prefer a little digital scale. You can find those for like $10 and just weigh the amount. So we always weigh out how much water we're putting in and how much coffee we're putting in. And those are a ratio. So the coffee to water ratio is what we always talk about. And that's a personal preference. So some people might really enjoy a more bold, so to speak, coffee, where someone might enjoy a cleaner cup. So if you want a cleaner cup, obviously get something with a paper filter. And just make sure to rinse out your paper filter to get any of that papery taste out. Discard that water. And then from there, it's all about time. So it's how much contact time the coffee and water are together will yield an extraction and the brew. So if you want to do a French press, I would say start with 4 minutes, 4 to 6 minutes. And if you're doing a pour over, it's a little bit more labor intensive. You know, I would probably, you know, do at least 3 minutes or so.
And can you make up a big batch and let it and keep it warm for a while? Or do you recommend keeping on making small batches?
Well, that's okay. I mean, we all have different lifestyles, so you know, if you have a large family at home and you want to use like a home drip machine, just, you know, that's totally cool. We're not like against anything, but I think that if you are doing one cup at a time, that's always a great way. If you do a big batch, just make sure not to like sit it on a burner and continuously heat it. So, and also like once you brew coffee, it's always best if you let it cool down just a little bit. It'll open up sort of like wine.
Thank you so much, all of you, Clint Hunt, Antoinette Hunt, and Sarah Yetter of Abracadabra Coffee in Woodstock, Vermont. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Antoinette Hunt, Clint Hunt, and Sarah Yetter, to Susie Stultz, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.